Welcome to the Nation Magazine Podcasts. You're listening to Nation Conversations, exclusive audio of Nation forums, events, seminars, and salons.
I'm Kevin Gastola, a Nation Magazine intern. Joining us for a conversation is Andy Worthington. Andy Worthington is a journalist and historian who is based in London. He is the author of the book The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 759 detainees in America's illegal prison. And if you have been following Greg Mitchell's WikiLeaks News and Views blog at thenation.com, chances are you have seen an update linking to Andy Worthington's analysis of the Gitmo files in the past 48 hours. To begin the conversation, how would you summarize these files to somebody who doesn't know what has just been released? And also, for the record, how many people are imprisoned at Guantanamo at this point?
Okay, well, you know, there were 779 in total, and there are 171 still there. And, you know, these files deal not just with those who are still there, but with almost everybody who's been held. And what they are is that from 2002 until essentially when President Obama took office, there the analyses and the recommendations of what to do with the prisoners that were made by the Joint Task Force in Guantanamo. That's the military responsible for the prison, and it's other groups that had input. So it's actually the interrogators in particular. And also the what are called the biscuit teams, the behavioral psychologists, who played a very, very crucial role, a crucial and rather horrible role in Guantanamo, advising the interrogators of ways to exploit prisoners by using psychological maneuvering and preying on their weaknesses and their phobias and their fears. So that's what these documents are. They're the military analyzing what they think they know about the prisoners and how they think they know it, and then suggesting to, you know, the people higher up who are making the ultimate decisions, you know, whether they're going to follow these directives, you know, that they're saying that prisoners are high risk, that they should continue to be held, that they're medium risk, or that they're low risk.
Some of what has come out has focused on these unreliable informants. And it's also been said that these detainee reports are pretty shoddily written. At least, it seems to me that in comparison to the cables that we saw come out in Cablegate, that they are much more poorly put together.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure there's ever anything been put together that well, really, when it comes to Guantanamo, because, you know, back in 2006, when we were getting documents released, you know, that was when the through freedom of information legislation and actually a lawsuit that was brought against the Pentagon by various media groups. Those documents that were released that were the names and nationalities of the prisoners and transcripts of the tribunals that were held at Guantanamo and the evidence that was accumulated, you know, they were kind of cut and paste jobs full of contradictions, drawing from all kinds of different databases, you know, put together by people who had, you know, been assigned the task of putting together what the military claimed was its case against the prisoners. You know, so that was done in one shoddy basis back then, and what we have here, again, is another kind of shoddy basis for claiming why prisoners should be held on a slightly different basis, much more detail in a lot of ways than we've ever seen before. But as you mentioned, Kevin, and it's the supremely important thing about these documents to me is, where is this evidence coming from, and how reliable is it? And you know, and what any kind of investigation of these documents reveals is that, you know, pretty much the whole story rests on interrogations of other prisoners. Now, either these people were in Guantanamo, or they were in other secret CIA prisons. The way it generally happened was that they had these photo albums of prisoners, which they would show to the people that they had in captivity, and, you know, and say, you know, who do you know this guy? Who is this guy? How do you know this guy? You imagine the circumstances in which people were held, not just in Guantanamo, but in these secret prisons where torture was used, a variety of facilities around the place, and people are shown photo albums when they're not exactly being held in a humane manner. What kind of stories are you going to get out of people? Well, you get some of the kinds of stories that are in these files. There are some pretty notorious high-value detainees whose testimony is used over and over again, apparently to establish the case against various prisoners. But, you know, one of these men is Abu Zubaydah, the first high-value detainee. The Bush administration's torture program was developed for him. He was held in secret prisons in Thailand, in Poland. When the Justice Department lawyers who shamefully attempted to redefine torture so the CIA could use it on him, he was then subjected to waterboarding, a form of controlled drowning, 83 times in 1 month. You know, we have on record people from the FBI who spoke to a Vanity Fair reporter a few years back who said, you know, when Abu Zubaydah was being interrogated and tortured, you know, they were distracted from doing any meaningful work because they were chasing after one wild goose chase after another when everything that he came up with when he was being tortured, which was rubbish, they were required to follow up on. So how reliable are we supposed to think this man's testimony is? Very unreliable, I would say. You know, so we have these people. And then we have, within Guantanamo, prisoners who are informants. Now, you know, the lawyers for the prisoners have known about these guys for a long time. Some of these stories have surfaced in the press, and some of them have surfaced in the prisoners' habeas corpus petitions in the district court in Washington, D.C., when judges have looked at unreliable witnesses and said, you know, we don't trust this guy. The famous one who's been exposed recently, who appears in, you know, over 100 of the files, speaking out against his fellow prisoners. When his testimony was ruled out repeatedly by judges, you know, they noted that he had not only been criticized, you know, by lawyers and by the prisoners, but you know, the military themselves, parts of the military had severe doubts about how reliable this man was. So in some cases, he's been touted as, you know, a great informant. In other cases, you know, exposed, I think, it would be fair to say, as somebody whose testimony was not reliable, you know, who secured more favorable conditions for himself as a result. I wouldn't blame him. You know, the pressure these people were under was enormous. But him and others, and there are other examples, you know, these people, their supposed evidence makes up the majority of the cases. Because essentially, when Guantanamo opened, the U.S. military, the Bush administration, did not know who it had. It hadn't screened them. It had bought most of these people from its allies. That's the, you know, foundational horror of Guantanamo, really.
You're talking about these revelations about interrogators, and so what can you say about something that is coming out of these reports? For example, in the detainee report for Abdul Qaddus, in the coordination section of his report, you can see a disagreement between JTF, Gitmo, and CITF over whether he poses a high risk or not. What can you say about the internal battles going on at Guantanamo, which are revealed in the files?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to see them, isn't it? That in some of these files, and I mean, I'm very pleased that you picked up on that, Kevin, because nobody's been asking me about that over the last few days, but it is absolutely worth noting is that the different bodies in Guantanamo came out with different notions. Now, my feeling is that, you know, in these first few years in particular, when, you know, 200 prisoners were released in the first 2.5 years that Guantanamo was open, and most of these stories we've never actually seen before. So it's another, you know, particularly good revelation of this document release is all of these stories. In those documents, as you say, there are sometimes differences of opinion. And what I noticed in the few that I've seen of these is that it was more likely to be the military rather than the specific investigative force that was recommending the release. I don't know whether that's what you saw. I suspect it could work in different ways. And certainly one of the other cases that I saw, it was the Biscuit team. You know, Biscuit, it makes it sound funny, doesn't it? They're the behavioral psychologists. They really do have an enormously baleful role that they played in Guantanamo, because they were directing so much of the abuse psychologically. In some of the files that I've seen, they were the ones recommending that prisoners shouldn't be released. But the whole thing as well is overblown. I mean, what we have is, these low-risk prisoners who are, either extremely minor figures in the military conflict in Afghanistan at the time of the US-led invasion. So, forced conscripts for the Taliban, for example. Also, this is where the stories of completely innocent people seized by mistake are coming out. And yet, everybody's low risk. There is no risk. There are no fundamental mistakes acknowledged in terms of saying, hands up, we made a mistake, this person is completely innocent. Now, that may have been because lawyers were looking at everything that happened from the beginning, and, no lawyer would say that you should admit responsibility for making this kind of mistake, because you will get compensation claims. But I think it's an indication of how overblown the whole categorization is. So, innocent people can be low risk. What does that make medium risk? That makes very peripheral, insignificant people can be medium risk. And it's not much of a leap from that to realize that it's quite easy to get designations completely wrong and to have somebody regarded as high risk when all you have actually is a couple of bits of supposed evidence against somebody which look perhaps as though they're meaningful, but, fall apart under examination. And one story that I think has been examined today, but, I've known about for a long time, is Mohammed El-Ghirani, who's a young boy. I mean, he was 14 when he was picked up, I think, 14 or 15, from Chad originally, but he'd grown up in Saudi Arabia where his parents had moved. He was captured in Karachi in a raid on a mosque. Karachi is a very, very long way from the battlefields of Afghanistan. And they were just, the Pakistanis were just raiding a mosque. He ends up in U.S. custody. And then, one of these notorious witnesses trots out this story about seeing him in Afghanistan and him being a fighter. Ludicrous information comes out. He was supposed to have attended an Al-Qaeda meeting in London when he was 11 years old. But he never left Saudi Arabia. And if he had, he would have to have teleported to London. How is this feasible? It's not. The judge, Judge Leon, a conservative judge appointed by George W. Bush, he looked at the evidence, supposed evidence against El-Ghirani, and just said, this is rubbish, how dare you really put this in front of me, because these people are unreliable, whose supposed evidence you're relying on. But he had been regarded as a high risk.
You're discussing the juveniles that are being held at Guantanamo, or have been held, and I would like you to talk about that a little bit more, because I think most people hearing about these cases for the first time are really responding to these stories of juveniles. We have new details on Omar Khadr, Naqibullah, Abdul Razak El-Sharik, Mohammed Ismail, and then Ghirani, all juvenile detainees. So what profound details should people know about these detainees, and is this entirely new information, or did we know about these juveniles before?
Well, I think that's a fantastic point. It's like, have we been here before? And, for people who've really paid attention to this story over, this long period, it's over 9 years now. Yes, we have been there before in many ways. And, people have forgotten in many ways. That's perhaps an indication of the way that we live to get today. And there's something about our news cycle that's kind of giving us the attention span of the, proverbial goldfish going around the bowl and forgetting on each circuit what's happened before. But maybe that's a fundamental problem of attention spans that needs addressing in some way. I certainly think that it does happen with the way we digest news, is that, we forget it. The story of the juveniles in Guantanamo did come out initially in 2003. There was a famous press conference with Donald Rumsfeld and the head of the military at the time saying, well, Rumsfeld's actual quote was that these are not children. He refused to accept that however young anybody was, that they should be regarded as a child. That was unfortunate, I think, really, because in January 2003, the United States had signed up to the UN Optional Protocol on the Rights of the Child in Armed Conflict. which stipulates, you know, that everybody who signs that, which the U.S. did, is required to rehabilitate rather than to punish juvenile prisoners seized in wartime. And juveniles are defined as people who are under 18 at the time that their alleged crime took place. So, you know, blatantly not doing that, you know, presumably because of the exclusive novelty value of the war on terror, in which, you know, the normal rules about anything don't apply. But, you know, it's disgraceful. And when it was discovered that there were three Afghan boys at Guantanamo who, nobody's ever quite worked it out, I don't think. I mean, I think that it's possible that the youngest was 11 or 12 when he was first captured. But at any rate, you know, they're that kind of age group, 12, 13, 14 years old, these boys. They are the only ones who the U.S. military put in a special camp aside from everybody else, and fairly swiftly, you know, arranged to repatriate to Afghanistan. And that was partly, you know, in line with what they were supposed to do under the optional protocol about how they were supposed to treat juvenile prisoners. But, you know, I did an analysis of the number of juveniles about a year and a half ago, and I found evidence of 22 juveniles in Guantanamo. Well, apart from those three, nobody got any preferential treatment. They were lumped in with all the adults. They were, frankly, tortured and abused and treated as horrendously as everybody else. And Omar Khadr is by far, I think, the most famous of these. You know, the 15-year-old Canadian citizen when he was captured, you know, who was treated appallingly. And you know, to Obama's shame, he was put on trial last fall on trumped-up war crimes charges that were invented by Congress and inserted into the Military Commissions Act. The whole thing is an absolute disgrace. I mean, to be doing that to a child, and somebody who was a child when they were captured, only adds to the disgrace of putting him on trial on invented war crimes charges. So the juvenile story is pretty depressing. I mean, I think, you know, fundamentally what it shows is the complete disregard for any kind of decent standards, really, that you know, that this was a great problem on the part of the administration. You know, and at the other end of the age spectrum, you know, we have all these stories that can also be found in the documents of people in their 70s or 80s, you know, who were very old and ill, who were swept up and sent to Guantanamo. And what on earth does that demonstrate about the quality of your intelligence when you're doing things like, you know, turning up at a man's house in the middle of the night and taking him in because he definitely doesn't understand your questions, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, it's really, it doesn't make your whole program look very good, does it, really?
To wrap up our conversation, I have a couple questions about responses to the leak. First, what's your reaction to the Department of Justice emails to Gitmo defense attorneys telling them they can't look at the reports that have just been leaked or use them in the defense of the clients, you know, the detainees that they are representing?
Well, it's kind of ridiculous, isn't it? But it's the kind of thing that actually, you know, has been going on for some time with making life as inconvenient as possible for the defense attorneys. You know, I think the sad thing about all of this is that the prisoners won a major victory in the Supreme Court in 2004 when they were given habeas corpus rights. Those were then ostensibly taken away by Congress. So 4 years later, the Supreme Court revisited it and gave them habeas corpus rights again. They started having their habeas corpus petitions considered in the district court. It actually looked like the rule of law was working. You know, what's happened since is that there's nobody to stop judges in the D.C. Circuit Court, where there are some, you know, frankly rather unsavory, very right-wing characters, from taking over detainee policy. And Judge Randolph is the chief culprit. You know, under Bush, he was responsible for approving all the legislation about Guantanamo that was subsequently overturned by the Supreme Court. But now he has kind of free reign in the D.C. Circuit Court. And the judges there have been reversing and vacating successful habeas petitions by prisoners, have arranged so that nobody can be released from Guantanamo through a legal process, have gutted habeas corpus of all meaning. So this long, long legal journey that began almost as soon as Guantanamo opened with the first lawsuits has ground to a halt because of essentially, you know, political interference by these judges. The law has failed. The United States system of law has failed in Guantanamo. So, you know, this is just another nasty little piece of rubbish directed at the lawyers. But the lawyers' task has been made impossible. And, you know, Guantanamo has always been, I think, a political issue. And, you know, it needs to become a political issue again. I think maybe we need to see lawyers, you know, writing op-eds and, you know, talking on the TV and the radio and getting the word out wherever they can to say, you know, we have been defeated. The law has failed our clients. We need a political solution to close this case.
Finally, this information coming out, I presume, has been of some benefit to you since you've been following the stories of Guantanamo Bay detainees closely. I'm wondering what you have to say about what WikiLeaks has done for people. I think there's this thing that journalists do where they deride the organization while at the same time benefiting from that information. So how do you regard this information, and is it possible that we would have been able to read these reports if they had not been released by WikiLeaks?
No, I don't suppose that they would have come out by any other means. And I think that, you know, I think that in the desire to, you know, to have more transparency and to push back against over-classification, you know, both of which are problems with the United States government, this has been very useful. Guantanamo is a place where, you know, these were people who were, you know, initially the Bush administration tried to deprive them of any recognition points as human beings. I mean, they had no rights for 2.5 years at all. You know, they've always been referred to by number. You know, nobody's supposed to see what they look like because that might help to identify them as human beings. You know, in terms of transparency, in terms of trying to understand more about Guantanamo, I think that these documents are very important. And, you know, and I think they're particularly important now because Obama has failed so spectacularly to close the prison 9 years after it opened, when it really should have been closed. Here it is lingering on, affecting America's good name and, you know, and reaching the point where it had started to alarm me that maybe this place really was never going to close. And that's really, that's a shocking thought. But nobody seemed to care, Kevin, until, you know, hopefully this has stirred things up a bit because really seriously, it had almost dropped off the media's radar. President Obama had kind of given in whenever he was challenged. The Republicans had made it a huge campaigning issue on the most cynical of fear-mongering bases. Other Democrats were scuttling around like cowards as well. It became a horrible and really undignified process that we were seeing of stopping anybody from being released under any circumstances, of trying to stop trials taking place, you know, just shutting down any movement on getting the place closed. And I don't think anybody had quite, most people hadn't quite realized, well, you know, that's it. What's going to happen now? Do we think that at the next presidential election somebody's going to come in and make a difference? No. It had become plausible that 5 years could pass and, you know, and I'd be popping up again going, excuse me, this abomination is still open. Is anybody going to care about it? So hopefully it's woken things up a bit. You know, and it's been good, I think, to see certain commentary out there. Amy Davidson in The New Yorker, for example, you know, said, why didn't Obama do this? Why didn't he make these documents available and point out what they revealed and say, you know, well, hello, folks, I'm sorry, but, you know, the guys who came before made a real mess. That's what some of us hoped he was going to do when he came in. And, of course, you know, it's not what he's done. He has never really, you know, made a point of severely criticizing what the Bush administration did, let alone talking about holding anyone actually accountable for the crimes they committed, but not even to say, he said in a speech in May 2009 that Guantanamo was a mess, and he complained publicly about what a mess it was. But he hasn't ever, you know, indulged in a sustained criticism of the abominable mess that the Bush administration left in it.
All right, Andy, thank you for joining The Nation for this conversation.
Thank you, Kevin.
Nation Conversations is a product of The Nation magazine and is available on iTunes. You can hear more podcasts at thenation.com/audio. Thanks for listening.